getting handed down there by...
This is the workstation of the Labor Labor Consumer and Business Affairs Committee meeting on Friday, March 4th. This is the Senate Committee on Labor Consumer and Business Affairs meeting on Friday, March 4th at 8 o'clock a.m. in Hearing Room B.
Senator Wires, who agreed to be with us this morning to make a quorum. Senator Roberts is sick. The other two members are in Washington, D.C.
Now, that meeting will come to order.
Good morning.
Clerk will note those that are present and will take no roll call. We're going to change the order a little bit because of a request for people that are... that has some traveling to do. We'll take up SB 19 first. There's somebody out there that wants leadership.
They turned the heat up. Frank Howard, I think it would be appropriate if you testify on the amendment that has been offered.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Frank Howard, representing the Insurance Commissioner. Senate Bill 19, as it was originally introduced, changes the list of exemptions under the insurance code, people that can be exempted from most of the provisions of the code but have to comply with certain things to get a certificate of exemption. And we raised an objection at the hearing initially to this change in those exemptions. We thought it broadened it unduly, and we suggested that the particular problem that this bill was addressing could be met by making a change in the requirements for a licensed organization under ORS Chapter 750. The ambulance service that originally requested this legislation is a licensed health care contractor under ORS Chapter 750, and they have told me that their principal problem is the surety bond requirement under that chapter, which costs them quite a little money every year. And we agreed with them that that surety bond probably was of minimal necessity, and that we would draft an amendment that would eliminate that surety bond requirement under certain conditions. And that's what this amendment does. It says that a licensed health care contractor that has at least 75% of its assets invested in the facilities it is actually using to provide the health care may not have to, shall not have to have the surety bond that otherwise is required. Most of our health care contractors would not be affected by that because most of them are in the nature of financial organizations, not directly providing the health care themselves. Kaiser Foundation Health Plan is about the only one I can think of offhand other than the Eagle Point Ambulance Service that would probably meet this exemption. And The $50,000 surety bond is just seems like it's probably superfluous. If an organization is already geared up with its assets invested in the facilities, it's probably going to be able to maintain its ability to provide those health care services. And so we've submitted this as a solution to the problem that caused this bill to be introduced in the first place.
What would this do to a rural fire department that's in the ambulance service?
The only time the insurance code comes into play at all is where prepaid subscriptions are being solicited for providing ambulance service. And under the general definition of insurance, this constitutes an insurance arrangement. And ORS Chapter 750 specifically applies to organizations that provide prepaid ambulance service. So far, we have not had very much of that kind of activity in the state of Oregon. any ambulance service that does try to develop a prepaid subscription service would be subject to ORS Chapter 750. But under this bill, they could come in and, as long as they had $25,000 of net worth, they could be licensed. That I don't know where the typical rural fire department would fit in that. I think if there is a problem, Senator, I think you know, this ambulance service thing is probably a relatively new and expanding field, and there may be some attention needed to the provisions of Chapter 750 that call for licensing of all ambulance services that operate on a prepaid basis. So I think at the moment, for the Eagle Point Ambulance Service, this bill does what they're anxious to have done.
Well, I have had quite a bit of correspondence over, you know, from the volunteer ambulance services and their insurance rates, and this, but this bill doesn't affect that at all, huh?
No.
Shoot.
It gives them some relief.
Are there any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hannah.
Mr. Howard, if this bill passes, it's my understanding Eagle Point Ambulance paid a bond recently. Would they get a refund on that?
It would just depend on whatever arrangements they could make with their insurer. Mr. Miles of the ambulance service indicated to me that their insurer was willing to write the bond on a down payment of some kind, and that the in balance of the year's premium would not be required if this bill becomes effective and they don't have to have the bond in effect for the whole year.
Okay, but they can receive some financial help on that.
Yes, this would be, I understand, of immediate financial help. And for that reason, I should have mentioned, they have asked if an emergency clause could be put on this bill in order to save them the full premium for this year's surety bond. And we're certainly in agreement if the committee is willing to attach an emergency clause to the bill.
Thank you.
Any other questions? What's the pleasure of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I would make a motion to move the adoption of the amendments and also the insertion of the emergency clause.
Senator Hannon moves the adoption of the amendments and the insertion of the emergency clause. Any discussion? Any opposition?
Well, Mr. Chairman, what?
I'm all ears.
You have a question?
This is going to apply to the Kaiser Health Plan, as well as the Eagle Point ambulance.
It's my understanding that it would. Is that true, Frank?
Yes, it would apply to any health care contractor that had the bulk of its assets in its actual health care facilities. Its impact on a large organization is minuscule, because the bond require. I don't think the larger organizations have a bond anyway. They file the actual assets with us, like a savings account or certificate of deposit, that kind of thing. Save them the expense of the bond premium.
By the way, this is going to stand. This is going to be left unchanged.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Wyatt.
What, these, the Eagle Point Eagle Point Ambulance Service is not a volunteer ambulance service. Is that right?
That's right.
No, it is.
It is a volunteer ambulance.
The other one is basically the animal committee wanted to help out and reducing this $2,500 a year that they can spend for just the insurance.
Just to have a bond.
Right.
Okay, I don't have any more questions. Thank you.
Any opposition to the amendment? If not, amendments are passed. What's your pleasure on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I move the bill out with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Hammond moves Senate Bill 19 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Carson?
Aye.
Senator Hannan?
Aye.
Senator Grinstead?
Aye.
Senator Wires?
Aye.
Would you like to carry this?
Fine.
Your bill? Senator Hannan will carry the bill. Okay, let's go to 301. I believe there's some new amendments to that bill.
Yeah, I'll pass out the bill as you amended it and also the bill and over.
Mr. Chairman, the marked-up bill reflects the amendments adopted by the committee March 2, and I have also passed out a alternative draft of amendments, which does not change the substance of the amendment, but creates a new subsection and divides the language a little bit, which may be more clear.
Mr. Chairman, I move we delete the amendments of March 2 and substitute the amendments dated March 3.
Senator Carson moves that we delete the previous amendments and substitute the amendments dated March 3. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Hearing none, so ordered.
I'll move the floor do pass as amended, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carson moves 301 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Clerk, call roll.
Mr. Chairman, let me just explain for members. My understanding is the major concern was the thrust of the bill is to obviously to block the indemnification aspects of it. But in certain industries, primarily in the utility area, it's very common for the utilities to enter indemnity agreements or contribution agreements. So we wanted to protect that practice. And the amendments go to, I believe, and apparently Mr. Wyman does and others that helped us on it, to make it clear that the bill thrust continues to apply generally, but as to individuals or corporations that are associations subject to 757 or 760, they may continue to enter agreements or warranties that are contrary to the thrust of the bill, and then we change the effective date from tried to filed. And I think this does what the committee was talking about today.
Any further discussion? Not the clerk call roll.
Senator Carson?
Aye.
Senator Hannan?
Aye.
Senator Grinstead?
Aye.
Senator Wires?
Aye.
Senator Carson, would you carry that?
Yeah.
302. Rich, will you explain this?
This bill was heard once before the committee. This is the bill which would attempt to set definite statutory time frames for the Workman's Compensation Board to notify injured workmen of benefits, and also set a time frame within which the Workman's Compensation Board service coordinators would need to contact and work with an injured workman and refer that worker to either physical rehabilitation programs or vocational rehabilitation. At our last testimony, I think Bob Kennedy of the AFL suggested that 2 days would be appropriate on line six, and Chuck Gill of SAIF felt that 90 days would be appropriate on line 10. Of course, those are only suggestions.
Are there any other suggestions from members of the committee? Is there anyone in the audience that wants to make a comment or a recommendation? Mr. Kalinowski?
Mr. Chairman, when we testified on this bill, we pointed out the existence of a House bill that had been introduced at our request that, just to add a little further confusion, has 30 and 37 days in it. I might ask if the committee's had a chance to review that bill. We suggested that it might be advantageous to merge the two bills for the same purpose, or for the same purpose.
Well, that's quite different than this. What's the rationale?
Does this bill, both bills, refer to a time period? Do they not, Mr. Chairman, to contact the injured worker following the injury?
Yes. In the first case, as I see it, it's 30 days instead of the two, and then 37 days in the second instead of the 90.
Right. My purpose in sitting here now, Mr. Chairman, is to ask if your staff had an opportunity to see if these two couldn't be put together.
Well, I think they can. As I read the House bill, this is basically a early warning type bill where there's going to be some kind of review made of the worker's injury and some kind of determination made early whether this is the type of injury that's going to lead to either a permanent total or partial, a permanent partial type disability. Does it speak directly to a set time period in which that worker would need to be contacted by service coordinators with a view toward actually getting them involved in a rehabilitation program?
That's the major thrust of the bill, Mr. Wyman, of the House bill. I know both the AFL-CIO and the AGC, and I'm sure other interested groups are very concerned about getting to the injured worker as quickly as possible so that he may get into either a physical or a vocational rehabilitation program as early as possible. The House bill sets at least what I think is a reasonable time period, 30 days, and goes on to say that the Workman's Compensation Board will do it if the private carrier or SAFE does not do it, and then they'll collect their costs.
As I understand the House bill, it would also create a new situation where for the first time the Workman's Compensation Board would have the authority to reduce an award of benefits if the workman did not participate in a recommended type of rehabilitation program. Is that
Well, it's been a while since I read my own bill.
Well, on page 20, on line 24, notwithstanding any other provision, if the board finds that the workman has refused to accept medical rehabilitation treatment as provided, the board may reduce any benefits awarded by the workman by such amount as the board considers appropriate. I think that's quite a deviation from what we have. It's approaching the same kind of administrative clout that we see in the British Columbian, the situation in British Columbia.
Right.
I apologize to the committee for not having this bill. It'll be here in a moment, the copy of the House bill.
Well, I didn't mean to delay action on the bill, Mr. Chairman. I simply wanted to ask if consideration had been given.
What's the status of this bill in the House?
It's in the House Labor Committee. It is not yet scheduled for hearing. As committee may know, there's, I think, 8,000 workman's compensation bills introduced.
It just seems that way, Jim.
It just seems that way, yes.
Well, it'd be my recommendation, if it's all right with the committee, that we do not take any further action on 301 this morning. We ask the staff to check with the staff of the House
302.
Labor Committee.
302.
I'm sorry, 302. And we'll proceed on with our schedule. Is that all right with the rest of the committee? Make sense?
Go ahead.
Yeah?
Chairman, we're going to run into this problem. We've got a number of bills that are, I've never seen so many identical bills introduced at this session, and somebody's going to have to make a move.
Well, good idea. Let's move on this, and we can send it across.
I'm not disagreeing with you, but I'd kind of like, I think, let the staff get together, but I think we ought to kind of set a deadline and say that by the 15th, if we don't have some indication of what's going to move. It's Alphonse Gaston routine has got to come to an end here pretty soon.
Right.
These things become trading stock, and I don't think they should.
I don't either.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wires.
As near as I could follow the discussion between Mr. Wyman and Mr. Kalinowski, it sounded to me like the House bill is different.
There's additional features of the House bill, right.
Unless it's more of the same than it sounded like, it seems to me like maybe we ought to go ahead with this bill here. This sounds like a pretty innocuous bill that we've got in front of us today, 302. Sounds like this notification is...
I'll rescind my earlier thinking if the committee wants to... and make a motion by, it's all right with me, I'll accept a motion.
I'd move the bill out with 2 and 90 put in.
Senator Wires moves.
I move to amend it.
Moves that on line 6 in the blank in the bill, 2 be placed, and on line 10, 90 days be placed. All in favor of the amendment, say...
Mr. Chairman,
could
I ask a question?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I haven't been here at all the meetings, so I'm not aware of all these adjustments and changes, but is 2 days realistic?
Weekends, holidays...
I mean, sure, we got to respond as soon as possible, but... I question whether we can actually do that within a 2-day period.
Anybody here from the Workman's Compensation Board?
Mm-hmm. Where? Right in the back.
What was the rationale for the 2 days?
That was the suggestion of
Bob Kennedy.
Right.
AFL-CIO.
Okay. Mr. Kennedy.
I'm Bob Kennedy, the Oregon AFL-CIO, and it was at my suggestion of the 2 days. The reason for this is after having visited British Columbia, where they have a very good system, after up there, the doctor has 3 days in which to notify the board that he has treated an injury. The board then makes a determination whether a service coordinator should or should not go see this injured worker. And if the determination that is of such a nature that they should have a service coordinator be involved, then the service coordinator is there within 2 days, and that's the reason for the 2 days. So it's really a total of about 5 days from the time that the person is injured until a service coordinator is there. But what we want is we want the service coordinator there at a very early date.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hanna.
Can I ask the...
Yes.
Bob, I'm not sure if I perhaps understand all this, but it would appear to me that 2 day period would be cutting it pretty short. One of the contentions of groups that have appeared here before is that the guy's waiting on the doorstep before the blood's even dry. Within a 2 day period is responding in a, say it's a holiday or a weekend, a 3 day weekend. Time restraints would not be able to fulfill that within a 2 day period.
Well, what the when you're talking about the blood drying, as I say it, we're talking about 3 days from the time the injury happens,
uh-huh.
Another 2 days on top of that. So it'd normally be about 5 days, but some of these persons are really concerned about, they really don't know how the system works. As a matter of fact, quite a number of business representatives don't even know how it works. And so what happens, they just say, well, contact an attorney. Well, we feel that an attorney should be involved in it at some time, but not right at the beginning. For instance, after C&E, if the person then feels that they haven't been treated fairly, then they should engage an attorney. But I don't see why they should have one before that time. And so this is the reason for the service coordinator being there early. And I can appreciate your concern about the holidays, and I think that a consideration could be given toward that, because that would be unreasonable to expect somebody to be out there on holiday.
Well, I'm just concerned that we don't write something in here that we're placing a time restraint that is perhaps unlikely to be fulfilled at one time or another.
Yes. Well, the thing about this, the only reason that I made the suggestion that in British Columbia it does work, and that was the reason for bringing this suggestion in.
Would you object to perhaps within 5 working days?
Or just plain 5 days?
Or 5 days, so that kind of gives a little bit more flexibility.
Senator Carson.
Could we also say shall send to, or if deliver means put in the mail, but the U.S. Postal Service, I'd hate to have workman's comp underwriting those fellows.
Well, this is, I'm a very strong supporter of service coordinators, and I think that not everybody might fully understand the brochure that does come to the injured worker at the end of 14 days or by 14 days. There's an individual here that's sitting in the front row that has had an experience. Maybe he might relate to you how long the delays have been, and so that you understand what has happened in the past.
Mr. Chairman, could I interrupt?
Yes.
Well, I don't think anybody disagrees with where you're going. I think we're just trying to find what's a reasonable period of time. I think we all agree with your philosophy.
Well, why don't the 5 work days, what's the matter with that?
Well, I suppose there aren't any sanctions.
I mean 2 work days, I'm sorry, and then because holidays are not work days.
Bob, you hit upon one thing, and that it appears that you're talking here about something more than dropping a brochure in the mail.
Of course, that is correct.
Anytime anyone writes a law about notification, you run into the problems of what it means. Does that mean that they have to drop a brochure in and get it postmarked within 2 days, or does that mean that a service coordinator has to go out and make the a phone contact or a personal contact? I think if you're thinking in terms of actual contact between the service coordinator and the injured workman, we might consider language to the effect that the board shall cause a service coordinator to notify. I would think that the easiest way to comply with this, if we did pass it, would be to drop a brochure in the mail.
And as I stated earlier, that not every situation, I don't think, would call for the services of a service coordinator. Once the report comes from the doctor, and let's face it, we have a toll-free line now to the board, so there isn't any additional cost to the medical profession to notify. All they have to do is make a call and tell what has happened. And then the board go from there, and if they think it's a serious type nature, why then, where it would call for the services of a coordinator, well then that would happen. But otherwise, why?
You would be happy just with the mailing of a brochure within a couple of days. You think that would be an improvement over what we have now?
Mm-hmm. Well, the minor injuries, I'm not concerned about those. I'm concerned about the serious type nature injuries that do need the services of a service coordinator.
Of course, those would be picked up under subsection 2 within 90 days or whatever.
No, that's too long.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the problem.
I just use 90. Within the section 2, the intent there is to actually get the service coordinator on the scene.
Well, what is happening now is they're too late from getting there, and
mm-hmm.
I've heard a lot of people talking about the litigation that has been happening, and quite frankly, that's part of the reason it happens, is because the service coordinator has not been there, and the persons do not understand their rights. And so they are just advised by, as I said before, some business representatives that don't understand the system. And so an attorney is involved in the situation from the word go. And as I said, I'm not opposed to attorneys becoming involved at the stage where I feel that they should be. But it has to be of an early nature.
There, at a 90-day limitation, there's certainly no requirement that the board has to wait that long. It would seem to me that the Workmen's Compensation Board, if they get on the ball, could do it a lot sooner than that.
I thought that would, personally, I think that's too long also at that stage of the game. But see, what that also addresses itself to is a determination of whether or not for rehabilitation, I believe, this type of thing, or referring the person to other types of services, when really there's times when maybe all this person would need is physical therapy and not rehabilitation. And so 90 days is stretching out quite lengthy. I think it should be a lesser date than 90.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hammond.
Well, Bob, my concern is, hey, this refers to disabling compensable injury. And if a
right.
person's disabled, he's going to be longer disabled than 2 days or 5 days. So it's not going to be an immediate thing that has to be right there. And that's my concern, that we just don't make it too short a period of time. I agree that what you're after, that you need to get the services to the person. My question, my concern is, I can't accept too short of a period of time, because I think we're going to wind up having to hire more people to go out there so they can be there at a 2-day interval to be at here at these different places. And I can just see some other areas that might be affected with this.
Well, I think that the employers feel that it's a service coordinators are a good investment.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wires.
Thank you.
Now that we've spent so much time with this, I'm beginning to question the value of this bill at all. Having worked around and in complex organizations, both private and public, I wonder how much good it's going to do to have a law that says somebody's got to do something within 2 days, and there's no penalty here. There's no way that the injured workman or the employer can enforce this. It's going to come down to some, actually somebody having a program and a philosophy and a direction in their organization to get this job done. And I would defer to more experienced people, senators or other people that told me I was wrong, but I just wonder what will happen to this. It seems to me that we're going to make a statement, you've got to do this and you've got to do that, and it's really going to be determined by how much money they have for service coordinators and what policies and what kind of a program is really pursued to get the job done, rather than us saying 2 days or 5 days and this kind of thing. So I would withdraw my motion.
I think your response to that is the fact that the whole point of workman's compensation is to get the person rehabilitated as soon as possible, back in a functioning capacity as soon as possible, to get him back to work. That's the whole intent and purpose of workman's compensation. Bob Kennedy's remark is well taken, the fact that he wants that person out there, a service coordinator, telling that person what benefits or what rights he has and as soon as possible. That's fine. My concern is not the fact that I'm opposed to providing those services. My concern is I'm concerned about putting too strict of a time limitation on there that cannot be responded within a reasonable time. So I think that's the difference.
If it meets with the approval of the committee, I'm going to appoint Jack Kalinowski, Bob Kennedy, and the gentleman representing the Workman's Compensation Board to get together,
and
George Moore, and come up with a recommendation to fill these two blanks on this bill, and the next time we meet, we can decide. I think we've got, I was in hopes that this had already been done, but evidently there's too much disagreement in the time frame. Does that meet with approval of the committee?
Yes.
Fine. Okay. Is that all right? Why did I ask that? That's just what I said was going to happen.
You're the chairman.
Okay.
303.
Mr. Chairman, this bill has been heard by the committee before on February 9th. The bill would change the situation that presently exists under workman's compensation that prohibits release of by workmen of any rights that are granted under the workman's compensation laws. It would provide for release for a lump sum by workers of all rights as long as such release is approved by the board, the Workman's Compensation Board, and there is a retained prohibition against releasing any medical or rehabilitation benefits. So what we're basically talking about, I guess, is permanent partial awards, permanent total awards.
A lump sum award.
Yeah, compromise and release right. of those rights for a lump sum award.
With the purpose that the injured workman could go into a business of his own or something like that if he so desired.
Or go to Reno and blow it all.
What? I just mean, if you compromise.
We've had testimony on this. What's the pleasure of the committee?
Whether this would affect no, it has not. And,
Chairman, do you recall any testimony about how many releases we're talking about?
I don't recall that there were. I remember the testimony on the bill, and I don't think the members entered into the testimony, Senator Carson. Is there anyone here that could give information along that line? Would you be interested in receiving testimony in that line?
Not particularly. I'm not terribly impressed by the bill to begin with, and I was just trying to assess the depth of need for some protection. In other words, we're interfering with the ability of a person to make a judgment for himself, and saying that he has to get some government to approve what he's doing. And if there's some substantial need, then perhaps. But I don't. I recall the purpose for which the bill was introduced, but I guess it's supposed to open it up, isn't it?
Of course, under the present law, it would be impossible.
Can't do it at all.
Yeah, it would be impossible for him to enter into any kind of release and compromise agreement. This would allow.
That's right. It works.
A modified system of release, as long as it was approved by the board, and
that was the objection, that aggravation would be eliminated then.
Well, I think there's a real question if a workman gets an original award and then goes in on that injury and compromises and releases that award for a lump sum and then has a later aggravation of that original injury. I think there's a gray area, a question of what effect that compromise and release is going to have on the later filing for aggravation, and whether it would be possible to receive benefits later for an aggravation of an injury that had already been compromised and released.
Shouldn't we answer that question? As long as we raise it, say yes or no, I would think. I think your point's well taken.
I don't know the answer to it.
We could answer it right here.
Yeah, it needs someone who has worked in this area, and I think it's going to be. I think maybe it will be a matter that will be settled by the courts. I don't know if there can be an absolute answer until it gets to the courts. But I think it is an important question. We could put in
law to further claims, including aggravation.
Oh yes, but you could go either way on that.
Yeah,
in the statute by amendment.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Carson,
was there any discussion under by the board what they? I don't recall any. What criteria they would use to grant the waiver?
I don't believe there's too much discussion of this particular problem, as I recall it. Sensing a certain amount of uncertainty on the attributes of this measure, and I think I'll just pass it over because I don't think we'd have the votes here to get it out if it came to a motion, and operating on such a narrow margin, I don't see why we should go any longer. So,
do we want to table it or just...
No, I don't want to table it. But let's just set it over and go to the next bill. Bill 4, if you remember, this is the bill that would change the name of the Compensation Board to the Workmen's Compensation Board to the Workers' Compensation Board. And after the bill had passed out and it was signed to Senator Robert Sicaro, I raised the question of what would happen to all the stationery and supplies and so forth that they might have on hand. So all we're doing here is, I guess we'd have to rescind the action that we took and then ask for amendments and put an effective date of January 1, 1978 in it.
Rescind what action?
The action that this committee took to send this to the board.
It was given a due pass and assigned to Mary Roberts. However, it was decided after that we should consult the agency affected to find out when would be an appropriate time.
Mm-hmm.
And on the basis of that is where we arrived at the January 1, 1978 date, so we want to put that in, into the bill.
What I'm trying to determine is, did the bill, was the bill referred back from on the floor? Or
no, it never went to the floor.
I move we reconsider the vote by which we passed the Senate Bill 204 to the floor.
Senator Carson moves that we
don't.
You
can't do,
wait a minute.
You have to wait.
Get a cup of coffee.
All right.
Let me ask about, while we're in a subcommittee, I know what you're trying to do with taking effect on January 178, but do you think there's any need to allow them a phased-in period? I don't. It just seems to me that it, we're not hung up about stationary and all that kind of stuff, are we?
No, as a matter of fact, when they were contacted, they originally suggested July 1, but then they were wondering if there could be something in the language to allow for, you know, things of that type. But then we concluded that it would probably be easier all the way around if they were agreeable to the January 1 date.
Well, the only problem, Mr. Chairman, is that we're desperately hopeful that the revised ORS will be published and out in the public's hands in December of 77. You have a problem of whether to do what this bill suggests. Do you delay it? And then if so, then two more years are going to go by. Do you anticipate it and put in workers' compensation? It's not that big a problem. All we're trying to find a...
I'm sure they could split the difference.
It would seem to me that maybe another way to do it would be to make it effective, like on October 1 or some such thing like that, but then give them a little leeway to phase into it.
That's agreeable with
no one. I don't think anybody's hung up on
no,
that.
No, I don't. October 1 would meet that requirement.
That's a council problem, I think, a little better. And then they could print the statutes with workers' comp in it. And then if we put a phase in so that they can change their signs and stationery and phone books and job titles, et cetera, as they move along. Is there a phase in, or is it?
I don't recall a phase in.
No.
It's going to be difficult to discuss this with that sea of women out there. You know what's that?
What's that?
I said we better be careful how we discuss this with a sea of women out here.
Good. Yes. He didn't suspect there were
one. That one? Scotty.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. Are you going to move to just change that to October?
I'll move to change to October and then conceptually some recognition, if it's necessary, of a phase-in so that on and after October 1 they can start changing over signs and stationery and all that kind of stuff.
First thing you need to do.
Right.
No, they're literally.
How to keep the show moving.
Yeah. The average meeting, people are coming and going, but that's no effect.
Where did our quorum go?
So refer to the cars, and do you have any language to suggest? I could see a long notwithstanding clause, notwithstanding this rule. In the view of a tire of the board shelf, phase out of stationary.
Well, could I ask Mr. Moore or somebody, Bulletin or somebody?
This motion to reconsider this 304. We voted to
check. What are we talking about in a phase in? That ORS, your rules, we can let you do those when you reprint them, I think, rather than. Wouldn't that be advisable to do it when you reprint them rather than thrash out a whole new set of rules just to make that correction?
We could drop a phrase in as soon as possible under the board's discretion.
Yeah.
This kind of thing, and that gives them plenty of leeway.
The question would be, is there any advantage putting the emergency clause in going July 1 to click into their budget?
The board is the only real thing we're concerned with.
Right.
To get this before us, Senator Carson moves that the committee reconsider the action they took in sending 304 out of committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion's carried. Now we have 304 before us again. Senator Carson, do you wish to make a motion?
Well, what if we put the emergency clause and made it effective on July 1, and then, as Richard indicates, give them a phase-in opportunity?
Give them discretion to phase in.
Yeah.
The comp board.
Yeah.
You draw up that language.
Yeah, it would be easy. It would just be something to the effect that the Workman's Compensation Board shall comply with this section within their discretion.
As soon as practical.
Yeah.
Okay. Everybody comfortable with the motion?
Is the board saying, is that all right? Effective the 1st of July, and then having the board phase it in as soon as practical thereafter? As forms come up and change signs, and as you reprint your rules and stuff like that.
You've heard the motion, clerk, sure. Call the roll.
Senator Carson?
Aye.
Senator Hannon?
Aye.
Senator Drewston?
Aye.
Senator Wires?
Aye.
Senate Bill 63. Senator Roberts will carry this bill. She was assigned to it originally.
Sets of amendments. One as a result of recommendation by Austin Crow of the Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association. The longer one, much longer one, was prepared by Legislative Council, as was the first one, after a meeting with the Insurance Commissioner and Tom Bissonette of Oregon Mutual Insurance. And they are not mutually exclusive.
although they would have to be dovetailed together at the very end by legislative council. There seems to be no objection. Basically, they were arrived at following the initial hearing, and all parties seem to be in concurrences to adopting them.
Is there anyone in here that wants to explain these amendments?
Mr. Howard, would you care to testify?
I'd be happy to try to give a quick explanation of these amendments. This bill, Senator, as it was introduced, makes certain changes in the way the Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association operates. The Guarantee Association is the body of all property and casualty insurers in Oregon that is formed for the purpose of picking up the tab when one of the companies becomes insolvent. The way the law presently works, the first $100 of each claim is excluded, and unearned premiums, that is the unexpired portion of the premium, is not covered by the Guarantee Association. Under the law, the insurance commissioner holds certain deposits from these companies that become insolvent. And there is no provision in the law now that explains just what happens to these deposits when the Guarantee Association steps in and pays the claims. The deposit laws were all adopted long before there was such a thing as a Guarantee Association. And so in the bill as originally presented, the arrangement is made that the deposit will now cover unearned premiums. The Guarantee Association will cover unearned premiums. The first $100 deduction is eliminated, and the intention is that under the existing law, the Guarantee Association actually stands in the place of the claimants after the Guarantee Association pays off the claims, so that the Guarantee Association then has a right to those deposits. What these amendments do is provide a plan under which the deposits can be made immediately available to the Guarantee Association, so that instead of going out and assessing another $50,000 or $100,000, which they eventually will get back from the deposit, this just shortcuts that procedure and allows the receiver, which would be the commissioner, to ask the court for approval of a plan for the deposit to be made immediately available to the Guarantee Association. Again, the plan presented by the receiver to the court would call for the Guarantee Association to return any part of the deposit that was not needed by the Guarantee Association or that was needed for any other claims that the deposit might have been held for. Basically, the main claimant against the deposit is the Guarantee Association in its rights that it has obtained by paying off all the loss claims and the unearned premium claims. So this is kind of it's a very logical step just to give the association the deposit since they're going to pay out the money anyway. Covered in this amendment, what would be the new sections 1 and 2 and 3. Now, one of the features that is being added under the present law, the Guarantee Association has the individual insurers in the Guarantee Association are specifically allowed to increase their rate filings in the future to make up for the assessments that they have been subjected to by the Guarantee Association law. This amendment would adopt the same privilege for them as the Life Guarantee Association has of offsetting against their premium taxes over a five-year period the amount that they are assessed to pay these loss claims of insolvent insurers. and then the bill would logically then do away with this premium increase provision. That's the repeal of 734-680. In its place, it would substitute a premium tax write-off over a five-year period of the amount of the assessment. Section 4 of this amendment is very long, and all it does is make a housekeeping change in the public records law. On page 8 of the amendments, the two underscored sections, 734-650 and 734-830, Attorney General's office called our attention to the fact that in those two sections, there is the provision that those records are confidential, but there is no similar cross-reference in the public records law, which there should have been. I think it was the one law, 830, was passed later than the public records law, and the other one was earlier and was just inadvertently omitted. But this is merely a housekeeping matter, and takes up a number of pages of this amendment. And finally, that's all that those amendments do, this large packet. The other amendment that was submitted by Mr. Crow is intended to take care of a problem which is a rather difficult one to get at. It arises when an accident occurs and a person has a claim against his insurer, an injured party has a claim against a tortfeasor who is insured by an insolvent insurer, and the injured party under the law, because the other party's insurer is insolvent, the injured party collects from his own insurance company, for example, under an uninsured motorist clause. The law now says that the guarantee association can't go back against in that case, the guarantee association has no liability. The law does say that the guarantee association cannot exercise subrogation rights against insolvent insurers or against any other insurer, but there is no protection in the law now for the person whose insurance company became insolvent. The uninsured motorist carrier can, under the present law, go against that tortfeasor personally, even though he was insured and he had protection under the guarantee association. Because of the way the thing works, he can still be sued individually by the company that paid the claim. And that's the purpose of this amendment, is to give him that personal protection against against insurance companies or guarantee associations up to the limits of the policy that he held in the insolvent insurer.
Is this avoiding double recovery? Is this the way you put it? Or?
Well, no, it's avoiding the insurance companies trying to get back what they have paid out from the individual who caused the loss. And it's a loss they otherwise would not have been able to recover from the guarantee association, but they go against the person individually. He's just left naked because his insurer became insolvent. The whole purpose of the guarantee association is to prevent losses because of insolvent insurers. And if there had been no insolvent insurer, this matter would never have arisen. But because the man's insurer becomes insolvent, the companies go around in a circle and eventually try to get back at this person whose insurer became insolvent. And some companies do, some don't. But this would close that door.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Rice?
Well, can't blame the companies to do it for doing it much. Nature hates a vacuum. I was noticing that up on the fourth floor of the new wing today. I've been watching with interest the empty space up there, and I'm very relieved to say that it's filled now with new furniture, which will be set up soon, and I'm sure it will be filled with people soon after that. But I don't quite understand how the circle is disclosed yet. I know you've explained it, and I've followed most of it, but not quite all.
I wish Mr. Crow were here to explain it, because it's a little outside my field, but I can cite one specific kind of case, and perhaps if you and I are the participants here, it'll be simpler to understand. Suppose that I'm covered by an insurance company which becomes insolvent, and you and I have had an accident and I injured you. Normally you would sue me or collect from my insurance company, but my insurance company became insolvent. Then the law says that, or in your policy says that, in this event you go against your own insurance company under your uninsured motorist clause. They pay you the amounts that my insurance would otherwise have paid you. Now your insurance company there's no prohibition now for your insurance company then to sue me individually for the amount that your insurance company paid you.
Well, why don't I sue you in the first place and then the guarantee company
association come in? Because there is a provision in the guarantee association law that says that you will look to other policy coverages that are available first before you go to the guarantee association.
Now, this is another way that the insurance companies that remain solvent have agreed in advance that they will spread the risk rather than having it all fall on the guarantee.
Yes. Yeah, the guarantee association is supposed to be the last resort.
If you didn't have an insurance company...
I follow it now. Well, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
Chairman?
Senator Carson?
A concern has been raised that if we don't have a threshold, if we remove the $100 deduction and don't replace it with 25 or 50 or some threshold, that the guarantee program will be besieged with demands for return of premium of small amounts. Do you have any feeling on that?
Well, there's no doubt about it that it will greatly increase the paperwork and the obligation of the guarantee association, because you are now dealing with every policyholder of the insolvent insurer instead of just every claimant against the insolvent insurer. And that's no denying that. The other side of the picture is that some unearned premium claims are substantial. If a man has a substandard automobile insurance policy, his premium may well be $1,000. The history has been that these so-called substandard automobile carriers are the ones most likely to go broke, and you may have a man with one company that goes broke, and his agent puts him in another company, and it goes broke. That's actually happened. So, bang, there's $2,000. And the fact that it's unearned premium doesn't make the pill any less bitter for the person who loses the $2,000. So it was originally felt that the people should just absorb this loss and the guarantee association be relieved of it. But
Maybe I didn't state that right. Maybe I don't understand it. But I'm not talking about getting back unearned premium. I'm setting a minimus or a nuisance or a threshold and saying, if your premium, unearned premium at the time your company folds is less than $25 or $50, no claim will be made. I'm trying to get at.
All right. You're saying that suppose, for example, you allow the unearned premium claims, but you have a $100 deductible from all claims. Well, there's logic to that process. The only problem, the big problem I see in that, Senator, is dealing with the special deposit law that we have, which doesn't have the $100 deduction, and I think you would almost have to put in that $100 deduction for the special deposit also, or the insurance commissioner would be faced with the problem of after the Guarantee Association has met its responsibilities, then these leftover $100 would all have to be met out of the deposit that the commissioner was holding. It would create a lot of complication, so the two would have to mesh. But certainly you could logically put in the provision that unearned premium claims would be covered, but $100 would be deducted from all claims.
Do you have any recommendations one way or the other?
Well, no, I'm kind of in the neutral ground here. Everybody has his own feelings on the subject. The Agents Association is particularly anxious to have the unearned premium claims covered. The agents have felt a responsibility to their policyholders and have been paying these unearned premiums, in effect, by obtaining new coverage for an insured and giving him credit for his unearned premium. So if an agency has a number of these in one insurance company, even at $100 a crack loss, it can be fairly substantial.
And the agents picked that up rather than the insurance.
The agents have been doing that. They haven't got any obligation to do so, but they...
And you think that's likely to continue, but if,
yes.
If I suggest $100 or $50 threshold, that the insured will get his money and it's just the agent that eats it, probably.
I think that would be the case, yes.
How about, are there any provisions for the remission of commissions?
Well, theoretically, an agent is supposed to pay back the unearned commission to the receiver of the insolvent insurer. And I think that there has been a great variation in practice among the states on whether this has actually been demanded of agents or not. We had an insolvency in Oregon in 1962, and the court considered that question and sort of compromised it. It did not require the agents to pay back the honor and commissions.
And you don't have any recommendation today,
no,
one way or the other?
No.
Mr. Chairman, is there any interest in the subcommittee on a deductible? I'm ambivalent on it.
Where is it? In here now.
Let him say it up here. Probably in the amendments.
That language is in the original bill on page 5, line 3.
Sound to me like would cause problems other places. So we might we might spend more money figuring that out than we would save on the paperwork in the next 2 years. I don't know. Yes.
Well, another alternative might be to ask the insurance commissioner to watch it very closely, and if we wind up just having spending inordinate amounts of time on small claims, then I think we have to reconsider that. I think the insurance commissioner's recommendation, obviously, it's his bill.
Yes, is to cover the whole thing.
The deductible.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask another question?
Senator Rogers?
This question may be outside the bill, but it's close to what we're talking about here, it seems to me. We're talking about piecemeal failure of insurance companies and what to do about it. What kind of protection do we have against economic hard times in the insurance area? We have a superheated economy with rapid inflation and so forth. And in the energy area, we're hearing that the energy supply is going to keep getting more expensive, and there may be a leveling of availability and so forth. Are there safeguards built into the insurance law against economic hard times? I wasn't alive during the Depression. I don't know what happened then. I've heard that we have wonderful protections against anything ever creating a reverse spiral like happened in the 30s, but I sometimes wonder where they are.
Well, the only specific thing, I think, Senator, is that in the life insurance area, there is a provision for a six-month moratorium on demand for cash values out of life insurance policies. Inflation has created hardships for liability insurers, casualty insurers. It has actually created a bonanza in some respects for life insurance on their existing policies. It's made it harder to sell new policies. But the inflation per se does not create a dangerous condition for life insurers. In the property and casualty field, it tends to make claim costs go up, and premiums must be adjusted constantly to keep pace with that. And it's hoped, I guess, that the pricing mechanism will keep up sufficiently close to the inflationary conditions and economic conditions that there won't be any great problem. The market restrictions that we have right now on availability of insurance have been caused by the failure of rating practices and the rating climate to keep up with the claim cost situation. And
it's my understanding, being a temporary chairman, isn't exactly the greatest sometimes as far as knowing what's going on is concerned, but my understanding that these amendments were worked out by a committee. They have the approval of the chairman of the committee, Tom Bessonette, Frank, and legislative council worked on the amendments. So what's your pleasure regarding them? Yes, Mr. Rice.
I don't think there was. I haven't seen the amendments that have been drafted, but just a moment, I might. Is Austin Kerr's the first one?
No.
Okay. No. I'm okay.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Well, we had one amendment that we were not in favor of, and I just wanted to make sure it wasn't included in this.
Okay.
I might just point out a typographical error, Mr. Chairman, on the first page of the amendment, the large amendment in section 2, the fifth line, the word D-I-S-P-E-R-S-E should be D-I-S-B-U-R-S-E.
Where was that now? On the amendment?
On the amendment, section 2, line 5.
Whatever. Neither one or the other.
Disperse in B-U-R-S-E.
What time is it?
U-R-S-E. Oh, okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Rice?
I think we ought to either go on or else take the time to read these amendments through before we move them out, move to amend. Whichever, I would like to do what you want to do on that, but I haven't read these amendments through carefully, and I wouldn't feel comfortable moving the amendments without doing that.
I agree with Senator Rice.
It would be obvious, it would be foolish, so we'll just hold this over to the next meeting, and we'll go to the next bill. 391.
We're going to get to 57 sometime?
Yeah,
thanks.
Is that how they got here?
It's
no. It looks that way, but...
No, I just asked.
Rich, will you take up 391?
This is Senate Bill 391, which we previously heard on February 11th. We have one amendment that's prepared by Legislative Council at the request of the various parties that testified at that February 11th hearing. And I would point out, however, that at the time of the hearing, there was a motion made and passed to delete Section 6, as I think Senator Carson phrased it, test the water. In any event, the amendment would have to be changed, and you'll notice on your copy there, it was not understood by Legislative Council that we had deleted this Section 279.055, so we would have to reconsider the deletion, which would in effect put it back into the printed bill. Then this amendment would effectively take it out.
Where is it?
It's the very last line and the very first line of the printed amendment here, of the proposed amendment.
Okay, last time the committee took this provides for local public contact review of the local government to have its own board. And the original grab a bill to deal with that.
Wow, this bill's a complete turkey. I'm surprised to see it back.
So he deleted that still, so that local contact review board can still be run. Now, he's saying that
if you want to have anybody disagree, Mr. Kalinowski,
Jack used to testify on this.
You would leave this one in, but you would be
Senator Carson, would you like to move to rescind your motion to remove that section?
I'm only left to do that, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
I'll do it if we want to adopt the other ones, but I don't want that section in the bill. And that repealer, and I'm a little reluctant to leave today's meeting with that back in the bill unless we...
The amendment, if adopted, would delete it.
That
amendment... talking about having enough...
Well, what I'm saying is, let's kind of make that a joint. I hate to move to take this to restore the repealer and then get hung up over whether we want this or not. I'm comfortable with the bill with that repealer out of there.
and I'd like the discussion until we're ready to adopt it,
right.
Mr. Chairman, to keep that repealer out, because I don't intend to vote for anything that has that repealer in it. Period. Yeah, local option.
Okay.
Yeah. Jack?
It'll reassure the senator at all. We suggested that that repealer that is in the bill not be continued in the
bill. Well, I understand. No, what I'm worrying about, Jack, is
yeah.
Sometimes we'll get caught up in our activity, and if we, for instance, if we don't adopt these amendments, then our reinstitution of the repealer leaves the bill back to where it was, and I might not be here next time, and it might get overlooked, and I'm more comfortable having it out until such time as we're ready to adopt these amendments, and then I'll be pleased to make that motion.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, would you like to have me go through the major thrust of the amendments, or the thrust of each amendment?
Yes.
No.
Does the committee have the marked up bill?
We'll all have copies.
The marked up bill?
Yes.
Is the bill marked up?
Not the marked up bill. Yeah.
We just have a copy of
the amendments. All right. Preliminarily, Mr. Chairman, I might say that there were several people who testified with some concerns about this bill. Immediately afterwards, at the request of the chairman, we got together. We prepared a draft of some amendments, and this, I believe, represents at least the consensus of the thinking of the people at that time that had some concerns.
Well, just to refresh everybody, may I interrupt? Against the bill originally were Clackamas County, Linn County State Highway, Marion County, and the Association of Oregon Counties testified.
Yes.
Now, would you tell us who got together that the chairman appointed to bring these in?
If I can remember correctly, the Highway Division, represented by Mr. Kesey, Mr. Graff, who I believe is from Linn County, did he not testify? And he was, and Mr. Penhollow with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I believe Mr. Hunderup with State Board of Higher Education participated. I think those were the major, major people.
Thank you. Proceed, please.
In line, the amendment to line 3 on page 2 of the bill deletes that repealer having to do with whether or not counties and cities and some PUDs can opt out of the jurisdiction of the Public Contract Review Board, and substitutes a repealer for a retained provision in the statutes that is a complete redundancy with another section of the statutes. It relates to the retainage by a contractor from a subcontractor on a public improvement project. That same issue was covered by Chapter 701 Oregon Revised Statutes, just an attempt to do nothing more than clean up a redundancy. In Section 1 of the bill, Subsection 1, people that we discussed this with suggested that instead of having a flat-out provision in the statutes requiring monthly progress payments on work as it progresses, that we insert unless the terms of the contract provide otherwise. The intention there is to say that it is entirely possible that some public bodies may want to prescribe at the time a project is being bid that the contractor will be paid in a different manner. We have no objection to that. The substitution of the word progress for partial, as it is in, I believe you have it in line 6 and also in line 11 and several other places, is simply to use a word that is consistent in the industry. Has no real significance. In line 21 on page 2 of the bill, the phrase "and the agency with approval of the contractor's surety shall eliminate retainage on monthly contract payments after 50% of the work under the contract is completed if such work is progressing satisfactorily." This is language that that is intended to replace a limit of any kind on the a dollar limit, if you will, on the amount of retainage that could be withheld. This is intended to say that if the public agency is satisfied that work is progressing properly, and the surety, the insurance company that's providing the bond, is satisfied that their insured is working properly, then the retainage may be reduced. In effect, what that would do, Mr. Chairman, is allow the possibility that at the end of the contract, no more than 2.5% of the dollar volume of work can be held. On page 3, at the request of those who exhibited some concerns, in line 3 and also in line 13, and I should also add, related in line 7, where we suggesting that instead of talking about completion of the work under the contract, we're talking about completion of all contractual obligations. And we think this is reasonable since in a construction contract, there are some other obligations. Filing of wage certifications is an example that is a contractual obligation that is not directly related to the work under the contract. This would give the public agencies more control. Line 14, there was some concern about the 15 days. We agreed to restore the existing wording for 30 days, talking about the time period in which interest will begin to run on a late payment. Or the amendments simply restore the wording that is in the existing statutes. The same thing is true in the amendments on line 3 and line 16 to 20. In essence, restoring the existing wording, instead of interest at the rate of 1% per month, it's 6% per annum, which is in the existing law. In line 21, the amendments there are to... excuse me.
Senator Larson.
What's happening here on line 9 of page 3? The shall may business.
Oh, excuse me. Senator, I'm glad you brought that to my attention. We discussed that in our direct testimony on the bill. I did want to stress, however, if I had the opportunity, the purpose of this. The existing law says that the contractor shall notify the public contracting agency when he considers the work completed, and then within 15 days the public body is to respond. The intention of changing the word shall to may is to say that he may do so, and if he does, then the second part or the last half of that phrase which requires response by the public agency, will be triggered. If he does not, then that response from the public agency is not triggered, nor is it mandatory upon them. Some public bodies, Senator, have interpreted this entire sentence with the use of the word shall to say that they cannot, in fact, terminate a contract until they get a letter from the contractor. That they cannot determine that the work is completed. So this allows them to say, without any notification from the contractor, we consider it to be complete. And by changing shall to may, that response by them is not automatically triggered.
Well, there was testimony here that day that when we had a hearing that the may could put it in a situation where the Alphonse Gaston, as was referred to earlier this morning, where the public agency contractor has pretty much finished what he's planning on doing, but he doesn't have an obligation to say so, and so the public contractor coming out kind of inspecting the work has to ask, are you finished with this, are you finished with that? And this shifts the burden, as I remember.
I don't remember that burden shift kind of thing, Senator, but certainly that isn't the intent. I don't believe the sentence read in its entire context would lead one to that conclusion. The contractor simply cannot unilaterally terminate a contract. The contract's documents, nearly all of them, very clearly take care of that. Should I continue, Senator Wires, or I don't want to leave that subject if you still have questions in your mind.
I was expecting to see something in the amendments about that. I've got a note here that I wrote during the testimony, and I had the impression that at least one of the public agency witnesses public contracting agency witnesses had raised a concern there.
Well,
you've got me on what the contracts say, because I haven't inspected any of them, but I don't know what question I can ask you to help make it clearer right now. I just,
well, at the present time,
we ought to go on to other ones,
and then
maybe I could say, for Senator Wire's benefit, in those that we discussed, the overall amendments to the bill with, I don't believe at any rate that there is any remaining concern about that. I suppose the next thing to address, Mr. Chairman, is page 4. In line 4, you'll see the addition of the words "and in a manner authorized by the Public Contract Review Board." This is inserted to ensure that anything that is done with the contractor's retainage by any public body would be handled in a manner that is authorized by administrative rule by the Public Contract Review Board. They have rules now that are applicable. And this wording would simply ensure that whatever is done in that manner. In line 10, You'll see the addition of the words, interest on such bonds or security shall accrue to the contractor. In my original testimony on this bill, I pointed out that counsel for the Gresham School Board questioned whether that was proper in a contract that they were letting for school building, and this wording is inserted to clarify any possible misunderstanding. In subsection 3, beginning on line 11 on page 4, there was some concern exhibited by some people that any retainage that is deposited by the public body in a bank account to be held in a secure fashion for the public agency and any interest would be subject to withdrawal by the contractor. We worked out the wording to say that in lines 13 and 14 that the interest is not subject to withdrawal by the contractor, but simply accrues to him. The next thing after line 14 is an amendment requested by the subcontractors, and again in my original testimony, although we did not know of the existence of that amendment, I pointed out to the committee that I knew such an amendment was going to be considered, and if it had the same requirements upon the subcontractor that the general contractor has with a public agency, we would have no objection. The amendment in line 29 is to coincide with the original amendment to that I discussed here today, to make sure that the cities and counties and PUD's authority to opt out of the jurisdiction of the Public Contract Review Board is not included in the bill. There is one other amendment that is being proposed. It has to do with bid depositories, Mr. Chairman. The amendment says if to avoid collusion and to increase competition between subcontractors bidding on public contracts, use of sealed bid depositories or bid registries where available is encouraged. There are some depositories or bid registries in the state of Oregon. I have a list of them for you. Where they are in use in Portland, Salem, Eugene, and Medford, they do have a great tendency to reduce what's called bid shopping by a general contractor of a subcontractor's bid, and I think it's entirely appropriate to encourage their use. It's not mandatory.
Why should that be in the law?
Well, Mr. Chairman, to bring it to the attention of the agencies, it's possible that public agencies are simply not aware of them, and if they are aware of them, they might want to require in their contract that they be used.
Would you encourage them with a match or two before? I mean, I don't get the point.
Well, there. Could I? I have the manager of the electrical bid depository in Portland here. Could I bring him up, Mr. Chairman? Would you like to hear from him?
Well, I guess it's all right. But Senator Carson, is this a point or not? You're a lawyer.
It's sometimes referred to as precatory language. It has no sanction. Akin to me to a preamble or a policy statement, and while I agree with you, it's a good idea. We either ought to say they ought to do it, they ought not to do it. I don't.
Right.
My view on that. I agree with you, Mr. Chairman.
We we'd like to see the use of these be encouraged rather than be made mandatory. Call it two-step legislation, if you will, but if they're brought to the attention of the public bodies and used and they're found to be acceptable as general public policy, then in future sessions of the legislature, you might want to make them mandatory.
Mr. Chairman.
Jack Carson.
I think my concern is similar to the chairman's. Is our function here to write laws for the conduct of various elements of our society, or is it to make recommendations on how to conduct bidding and so on? I might have a whole series of suggestions on how to conduct bidding, but I don't think it's appropriate. If we direct an agency to do it, or direct the state to do it, or some such thing, I'm not quibbling with you where you want to go. I think it's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I share the chairman's concern that perhaps putting a kind of preparatory language in the statute to encourage it is really beyond what we ought to be writing about.
Well, somebody else pointed out to me this morning, this is kind of like saying it is the intent of the legislature that public improvements will be constructed at the least possible cost.
Yeah, precisely.
Which is just
business.
Well,
it's the intent of the legislature to save costs. Now, how have we moved a great body of law forward or helped any citizener save one dime other than the cost of the bill to state our grand statement?
Mm-hmm.
We're for motherhood, apple pie.
I think the difference in this, Senator Carson, is that at least this brings the existence of these depositories where they are available in these four areas of the state to the attention of those people.
Would it not be better then, and I'm not suggesting this is what we ought to do, to direct some agency to bring it to the attention? I'm not sure that contractors sit down of an evening and thumb through the ORSs to find helpful hints on how to contract. Apparently, your view of the matter is a little different than ours. I think we either ought to tell a state agency, you're going to do this, or we tell all Oregonians to do it, or we get out of it. This is not a, I've said it.
Mr. Chairman?
Chairman.
I can imagine the contractors in Oregon sitting around in the evening chatting with Jack Kalinowski about helpful things.
Right on. I can see.
And he's here today.
Right. I can see AGC meetings, and I can see AOC meetings, and LOC meetings, and a variety of other things for people to discuss this, which I think they should.
Mr. Kalinowski could tell them about how he shepherded this through the committee and to help. But this raises another question in my mind that reminds me of Eleanor Zidlow. He used to have a lot of rental property in Stevenson and run the liquor store in the back of the state liquor store in the back of the plumbing supply store. And she used to always have a favorite saying, which was, "I'm not in this for my help." And I'm wondering how this helps AGC to have, which tends to be involved with larger contractors, I thought, to have a system that protects smaller subcontractors from bid shopping. Is it because you're representing the small subcontractors as well, or does it in some way help get larger contracts done at a lower cost?
Well, let me explain the purpose for a moment, Senator, of a bid depository. It's not the subcontractor who does the bid shopping. It's the general contractor.
Now, I heard you say that, yeah.
The general contractor, in all likelihood, if he doesn't have a high degree of integrity, will attempt to take a subcontractor's bid after the bid opening, and as a matter of fact, sometimes after a contract has been awarded, and see then if he can get another electrical contractor, if you will, to do the same work at a lesser price, which simply means that it's money in his pocket. The bid depository concept is one that would disallow that. Those who are members of the bid depositories just simply will not do that. And it's an integrity thing.
Well, let's just pass a law that says integrity is encouraged in the state of Oregon.
There you go.
I can think of a few responses to that, Mr.
Chairman, that I don't think I want to offer now.
Anything else?
I think that covers the amendments that are suggested, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions? What's your pleasure, the committee's pleasure?
There's a gentleman out there that maybe wants to testify.
Is there anybody else that wants to testify on this measure?
Chairman?
Mr. Bruni?
My name is George Bruni, and I represent the American Insurance Association. I was unable to appear last time to testify because I hadn't, by that time, received word from my client. It is a national organization and represents and has in its membership a number of surety companies that do a substantial amount of the surety business and contracting business in this state. It is opposed to reduction in any way of retainage below 5%. And it feels that the 5% is the absolute minimum. Retainage, the purpose of retainage is for the public body or the owner to have a handle on the contractor to require and him to perform the contract. The surety's position is that and the surety's premium on that position is based upon the fact that the contractor or the owner or public body does have that at least 5% handle on the contractor for completion of the performance of the contract. Now, Mr. Kalinowski mentioned that one of the amendments, I thought I heard this, was that if the contractor had, if the opinion of the public body, the contractor had faithfully performed the contract and had completed more than a half of it, then the public body could, in this option, excuse retainage altogether. And we support that. We feel that the public body should have that power. If the contract is more than 50% complete, then it could forgive retainage. But until it is, the full amount should be obtained. Now, the hazard of this, for under our present law, if the public body has the authority to require either a bond, a cashier's check, or some other form of deposit. I imagine that the well-advised public bodies disdain any other type of performance security than the bond and require it. The premium for the bond is based upon the 5% retainage. The surety industry gets a little apprehensive, maybe more than just a little apprehensive, when that retainage falls below 5%. And all of this gimmickry, which intends to bolster up and change the situation to reduce the impact from a reduction from 5%, is of no avail. If the retainage is reduced, then my advice for my client is that this will have an adverse effect upon the premium for this type of bond, and that the net result would be to perhaps reduce the number of contractors who otherwise would be able to participate in this bidding on this type of work because they wouldn't be able to procure a bond. Now that's just it's not a big issue, Mr. Chairman, but it's a point that I would like to have made originally, and I'm sorry that I couldn't have made it. There's no way this bill can be amended to satisfy my client in that regard. And I thank you for your permission to let me appear on it.
I'm glad you had the opportunity. There's someone else. Were there any questions of Mr. Bruni?
I just have a short one. Why is the availability of bonding based upon retainage? If Apparently, what the public contractor is really looking for is a bond and not the retainage. Why are the sureties so interested in the 5% retainage if the guy can pay the premium?
Remember now, in public contracting, corporate suretyship didn't come in until almost the beginning of the 20th century. At that time, it took the place of personal suretyship. At that time, the premium and the thrust, the theory of suretyship, was based upon the fact of retainage, which has been in existence for many years prior to the coming of the 20th century. So it's been a fact of life in suretyship ever since we've had corporate suretyship in contracting. And they've geared the whole system of it based upon this retainage. At one time, at the beginning, maybe in the 1900s, the retainage was around 15%. Then it got down to 10%. And I think in some government contracts, it's still 10%. And this 50% rule that I just mentioned obtains with respect to a 10% retainage, which can be altogether eliminated if 50% of the work is satisfactorily performed. So it has an adverse effect. The premium is measured on risk. And one of the funds that could come in the hands of a surety in the event of a shaky operation would be the retainer, the more the better, and in no way below 5%.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Carson.
Fast, George. If the amendment said that the bond could be reduced only with the consent of the surety, that would remove your major objection, would it?
If the bond could be reduced?
Well, if the retainage could be reduced only with the consent of the surety.
Yes, the retainage less than 5% would be reduced only with the consent of the surety. And then I imagine that would have to be, this has to be in the original contract document somewhere. I don't know that midstream that could be done.
Well, if the contractor were willing to do it, and the agency were willing to do it, and the surety were willing to do it, it could be done.
I think if all those parties agreed to do it, and they're able to do it, then nobody's prejudiced. We have no objection.
Okay, and the question then would be whether or not the public body is required to do it. That's the pivotal point.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, another question. Mr. Blaine.
You say your client is a national insurance company.
It's a trade association composed of about 150 companies that write casualty, surety, fire, and workers' compensation insurance. And most of the they're the capital stock companies as opposed to the mutuals and so forth.
Well, they've instructed you that that under no circumstances will 5% a reduction below 5% be acceptable. Without beating around the bush, what good does it do us to have it in the bill that it can be reduced below 5% if the surety will consent, if your belief is that they're never going to consent?
Well, I don't know. I believe that they will never consent to a reduction below 5%.
Well, what percentage of all the surety companies
I don't know that, Senator. My guess, the last time I checked that was several sessions ago, and I think that the ratio is still about the same. We probably represent close to 30% of the total premium written, and maybe higher than that in the construction industry, of the total premium written for construction contracts, both public and private.
Well, don't you think then that with the retainage being really the guts of this bill, that if we went ahead and passed it, knowing that that it wouldn't be improved, that it's categorically unacceptable to the people who are doing the surety work, that we would be knitting gossamers or something.
Well,
I'll ask you what that means later.
The surety industry center doesn't want to come in here and say that it opposes the legislation. What it does want to say is that from the standpoint of the surety industry, this is not wise legislation. It doesn't like it. It's going to have an adverse effect on the issuance of contracting bonds.
Well, I'm beginning to wish now that I'd said what I thought of saying 30 minutes ago, which was this, Mr. Chairman, this, I never thought we'd see this again after the chairman appointed the subcommittee.
Well, that chairman isn't here. Any other questions of Mr. Burney? Will you state your name then for the tape?
Burney. Chairman, I'm Jack Hunderup with the Department of Higher Education. Kalinowski identified me as one of the persons who participated in the drafting of some of these amendments. I would like to mention that this did not imply the concurrence with all of the amendments, because there was one very substantial factor that I addressed in my original testimony in the hearing on the bill that has not been satisfied in any of the proposed amendments. I'm concerned particularly on page 4 of the bill with subsections 3 and 4 of section 4 of the bill, which provide for the first time an option to a contractor to elect to have whatever retainage is held by a public body deposited into a bank, savings bank, trust company, or savings association. I indicated to you before that this would involve then a two-check payment for every progress payment that would be made. I also indicated that, I believe I did, and certainly intended to, that in the event that the contractor were to take advantage of the opportunity in subsection 4 to convert the amount held in a savings account for his benefit into securities, the bill does not address the question of who would be responsible for actually selecting those securities and actually purchasing those securities. Nor does the bill in its present form or with the proposed amendments respond to the question about whether a contractor can or could make a separate decision with respect to each progress payment, saying in effect that he could have some securities on deposit with the public agency. He could indicate in the next progress payment that he wanted the retainage withheld, and on the following payment he could have it deposited in a savings account, and he could ask that the accounts be switched from one to another, and the bill does not provide that. I'm sure the intent is to allow only one option, but the bill does not satisfy the response of whether such an option would be available for each progress payment or simply for a particular job. I have a firm conviction that it is not the responsibility of the public body to deposit the money for a contractor in any particular account, nor to allow him to switch from one basis to another during the progress of the job. And I would seriously request that subsections 3 and 4 of section 4 of the bill be deleted, leaving the two opportunities available for the contractor. One, that the public body would withhold the amount as traditionally has been provided in the statutes, and the other, which is also currently available, that he can substitute securities which are approved by the Public Contract Review Board in lieu of having any retainage. But I just do not believe that a public body should be in the position of having to split a progress payment and to maintain the savings arrangement that's contemplated by subsection 3 of section 4 of the bill. I've discussed this with others representing public bodies, and they concur in this same
argument that a public body should not be in the banking business for the contractor, that this should be the responsibility of the contractor himself in determining whether he has the retainage held by the public body or uses securities in lieu of the retainage. And if the option is to be provided for the savings, then I think the language needs to be modified to set forth the terms and conditions under which the securities may be purchased, or bank accounts may be opened and closed, or transferred between one bank and another.
Any questions? Well, I'm going to set, I'm not going to take any action on this bill this morning. It is obvious there's quite a few concerns yet. And when the chairman gets back, he can take it. That's what he gets for being chairman. Turn to 57.
You're kidding me.
No, I'm not. I want to thank the committee for their patience to
Mr. Chairman, may I suggest that Mr. Allen might be able to very succinctly and effectively state why this set of rascals is back here with us, and what changes have been made by your subcommittee, and what we, I will move, please explain.
Mr. Allen. Thank you. My name is John Owen. I'm the superintendent of the bank. I asked that this bill be brought back to the committee because there were two errors in it that were rather important. You have my testimony, and I'll just paraphrase it. There's two principal amendments. One is if we raise our fees beyond that which the bill permits, or seek permission to do it, we have to do it through two bodies. One's the legislature and one's the E-Board. The unfortunate language says Ways and Means Committee. So that has been removed and the Legislative Assembly language is substituted. I thought that would, you know, counting votes and things like that. So, then the other change is in section 12, 39, 42, 48, 50, 55, and 57 relating to fraudulent or dishonest practices or injunctive orders. And in the first section that this talked to, which was the banking section, it says the superintendent may, and then in these other sections it says the superintendent shall. So if we had somebody that had a traffic ticket or was busted at 16 for smoking pot or something, why, we would have to remove them from office, would have to pull the charter and so on, and that isn't at all the intention. So we've substituted the word may instead of shall, and that corrects that. And then in the area where we talked about the felony, the grammarians looked at this, and I couldn't get any consensus of really what it did mean, but the intention is that if someone has been convicted of either a felony or a misdemeanor, it must carry an element of fraud with it, or we can't look to it.
What line are you on now?
Page 27, line 11.
Page 27 is a typical example.
I would refer the committee, make sure you're looking at A and Gross Senate bill. It's in front of the one that's tabbed.
Mr. Chairman, to that point, Senator Kefouri brought up the concern, and so the suggestive amendment would make it clear that whether it's a felony or a misdemeanor, in order for it to be a ground for the superintendent to take action, it has to have an essential element of fraud. And that's what the superintendent intended, and we changed the language by adding the words, either of. So that
that shows up in all the sections. So it read, has been convicted of a felony or of a misdemeanor, either of which an essential element is fraud, which is fraud.
And that's kind of in keeping with the spirit of Senator Corey's request.
Senator Waters?
I raised a question about this on the floor, and I didn't like doing it there, but so I want to do it here. Maybe I can do it clearly here. I'm not
I don't think we ought to make things difficult for people who've done some little thing like put a plug nickel in a pop machine 20 years ago. But there's a parallel in my mind between the person we're looking for in the criminal system, the person who is going to commit a violent crime again. We want it some way or another. Get it out and keep locked up. And the person who has got a character trait that's going to be dishonest. And I think sometimes in the past, we've had a tendency to, somehow or another, these people who know how to dress nicely and so forth, and talk nicely, get past our attention. And I don't understand the niceties of the bill the way it is, but I was asking Senator Carson that day, and I'd like to renew the question now. Is there anything more we could do to guard against, force the, I guess it's a question of forcing the banking financial industry into ferreting these people out, because they do exist.
If I can speak to that, Senator, when we charter an institution, we seek financial statements, references, and fortunately in Oregon, this isn't so in a number of the states, particularly the large ones, but fortunately here we do know the people, or we know someone that knows the people and has known them for years. And so we can screen them at the chartering level. When we get past the chartering level, though we don't have the control over it that we would like to have, when directors are elected, officers are employed, examiners come in, etc., and we have not had the vehicle to get to the police records. We were barred from it because of some language that crept into the ORS in the last session or two, as you were. And so we sought to get that exemption and did not prevail. And that's why we then adopted this language, which has been acceptable language to that committee that was making those exemptions. Now, the rehabilitation concept, of course, is one that came up with Mr. Kafoury. And we looked to that. Indeed, we have chartered a credit union staffed by felons, ex-felons. And we looked into their background very carefully and to how long have they been out. What are they now doing in the community? Are they employed? Are they being active in public affairs and so on? And when we got past those tests, well, then we were willing to take the chance. But when we get into a area as broad as banking, where we indeed have a pyramid of dollars, billions of dollars in the state are held by a handful of people, in effect. We needed this protection to discover. Now we can go in and discover where we can. We have various ways we can do it, and it gives us a opportunity to remove them if we've got a pattern there that is bad. And of course, I think your point is that the integrity must be extremely high in this area, because we're turning the purse strings loose to a lot of folks.
But you feel, I guess I'll ask a Walt Brown type question. You feel that this goes as far as we can go in that area? It gives you as much strength to. One of the things I've noticed in the legal profession is that it's a commendable human trait to forgive and to want to help your brothers. But sometimes it's the people we know best that we're the most vulnerable to.
I have been victimized by round figure statements in my banking career, and I know of which you speak. I don't know how you're going to legislate conclusively on something like that. A lot of source material is at the federal level, and I'm talking FBI or whatever, and we don't have access there directly, although in banks, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation does investigate at a level at which we can't, and we have that additional safeguard, but
to be able to write legislation that will conclusively block, I don't know how to do it. Any more than we can legislate against, we have legislated against robbery and whatever, but it hasn't stopped it. And you never, and it's the first timer that is difficult to anticipate.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carson.
Following up on Senator Waters, have you had any boners that sometimes, like the parole board, where you have reviewed somebody who had a criminal record and he later was nailed for embezzlement or something? I mean,
no, I haven't in my career with the state. In 6 or 7, I've been 6 years. 6 years. But
I'm sure it's happened.
Well, I know it's happened. There is a bank president in one of our neighboring states who had a felonious record many years ago. But it was this sort of a pot situation when he was a child. And, of course, you can overlook that considering the 30 years that happened in between. But I haven't had anything direct, but in talking to superintendents around the country, particularly in New York and Texas, California, we had a notable example down there of a white-collar sort of a crime. It's a problem. I did have one situation in this state where a banker was doing some things that he shouldn't have done, and I removed him from office. I tried to get an indictment and wasn't successful. I tried to do it to go through the district attorney and all through, so through the FBI, and we didn't succeed, but at least we got him out of office and out of the bank.
Seen it, Mr. Chairman.
But I have that power to remove him and direct him to the board.
One more.
All right. The thing I'm thinking about is the person who's having some personality problem, which may be due to some acute situations happened,
marital health
in the family or marriage or something, or the person who just gradually weak. I don't know what words to call this, but
can't say no.
His personality is just gradually moving toward losing control of the limitations on him, and that we have an early warning system to trigger him off, because we all tend to kind of be reluctant to tear into somebody who's maybe known and worked with for years and has been doing a good job, and then we just see them gradually.
Well, we have that capacity now, because we do that through the examination process, and we're working towards automating a early warning system, setting up, we have our criteria set up, and then we document it with figures and facts and so on, what's the person loan, how bad are the loans, and what is the projection. If he's going downhill, we review that directly with the senior officers of the bank and the board of the bank, and very obviously they do it too. And what you speak of, we see very frequently. And without exception, these people find themselves out of a job in the institution. They're removed. There's no way that they can deal with fiduciary funds at any great length to the detriment of the depositors and the stockholders. So they're out. That one's the easiest one in the world to find. It shows up now.
Thank you for your patience, Mr. Chairman.
The bonding companies also are in
there.
Do we have to resume the action we had before?
I don't think so. These are in addition to the bill we sent out.
Senator Carson moves the amendments from Legislative Council dated 3277 that are before you. Any opposition? Hearing none, so ordered.
Move floor to pass as amended.
Senator Carson moves 57 to the floor, do pass as amended. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Carson?
Aye.
Senator Hannon?
Aye.
Senator Drewstad?
Aye.
Senator Waters?
Aye.
Thank you. Before we adjourn, I was presented with a bill to be entitled our committee bill. Okay. This was cleared with the chairman. It's from the Mortgage Bankers and Savings and Loan Association. I would. It changes. It has to do with usury rates. That's all I know.
From whom is it?
From the Mortgage Bankers and Savings and Loan Association.
I move we authorize its introduction as a committee bill.
Hearing no opposition, so ordered.
It's going to be great.
Committee has any money? You take that up individually, not as a committee venture.
What is her illness? Is it either serious?
I heard it's just a bad case of the flu.
Well, I saw a rumor. I thought she was pregnant.
Well, I asked her father if that was the case, and he said, no, it wasn't anything fatal like that. So I don't know. That doesn't mean that it is.
Well, it's got to be pretty bad. It's knocked out for a week.
Well, it's a traumatic experience for someone.
I wish we'd pass more bills. I was going
to it's hard to pass bills when you don't have a consensus out there. And I didn't really know where Drummer was coming from on those two labor bills, the compromise and the other one. I guess it's good to see him be back and do anything.
Excuse me.
Well,
I've been waiting a long time.
That's a long